It's Friday, May 17th, 2024, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellams. Today on our show, changes at the Bentonville Public Library.
There's a giant brick wall that's going to come down. And I think that I kind of dread hearing that work happening. While the library is closed to the public for the 2 weeks, May 20th through June 2nd, my team will be here working.
Plus, the books that made the cut for the Hugo Award for Best Sci-Fi or Fantasy Novel.
The Saint of Bright Doors is like this. So it's like high fantasy, but in a modern world. So, you know, while they're using magic, they're also sending each other's texts and emails.
We also get a review of a week's worth of news with Michael Tilley from Talk Business and Politics, and much more, all after the news from NPR.
KUAF is supported by Butterfield Trail Village, a premier Northwest Arkansas retirement community catering to active lifestyles and resident well-being. Offering daily activities, a variety of living options, plus wellness amenities, including an aquatic center and fitness facilities. ButterfieldTrailVillage.org for more.
This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, May 17th, 2024. I'm Kyle Kellams. Later this hour, we'll find out what's new at the Bentonville Library. It's going to close for just a bit to continue its expansion project. What we'll see on the other side just ahead. First, though, joining us from his office in Fort Smith is Michael Tilley with Talk Business and Politics. We've got some things to talk about this week. Michael, how has your week been?
It's going well. It's a very wet week. I think I may need some hip waders out in the backyard, but other than that, it's okay.
Well, let's get started with the Fort Smith Planning Commission. They voted a close vote, but they voted 4-3 against Unified Development Ordinance amendments that would create a military compatibility area overlay district. Help me out. What happened?
Well, so this overlay district is, we've been led to believe, is needed for this pilot training center that's coming to Fort Smith with some of the first jets set to arrive later this year, these F-35 jets. And so, again, we've been told that there are noise areas, buffer zones they need for noise, buffer areas they need for security and safety, whole host of things. So and initially, when these were first rolled out, the home builders were against it. So the city's worked with them. They're now on board with it. But there are still a lot of questions. I was at the Planning Commission meeting, and I was really surprised. This is what kind of surprised me, and I knew that the vote was probably going to go south on this when the Planning Commission Chairman Don Cassie said, "You know what? We don't have enough information on this." And he said, "You know, I have asked." Now, mind you, Kyle, this is the head of the Fort Smith Planning Commission. Now, he's a volunteer, but still kind of a high profile position. He's asked the city, you know, where are we getting these requirements? Did the military say we need these things? We have to have these things. And he said, I'm not getting an answer back. So that was a little, a lot alarming, but there are two key points that I've consistently heard that there's not enough info. One is on use of property in these buffer areas around the airport. There's some pretty restrictive language about what you can, mostly what you can't do with it. I think that people are wanting some clarification on that. And then the part of that is a rule on if you sell property in this area, it can't be sold to any foreign entity. Well, one attorney got up and said, what is that? You know, you could have, you know, what defines a foreign entity? You know, you could have some group that has, you know, 1 or 2% ownership from some company in the UK or France or Germany. What's a foreign entity? So that, you know, he said, you need some clarification on that. So, and then I think kind of what encapsulated it, there was a retiree, a gentleman named David Ingram, who got up, and I thought he was speaking for the project. He got up and talking about how much he loved the military, loved when the air shows came. He loves the noise of the jets flying over. But then he just pivoted and he said, but, you know, you guys haven't given us, talking about the city, you haven't given us enough information. His quote was, it's all abstract right now. We need to make it more concrete. And that was part of a larger quote, but essentially kind of saying, hey, most folks are for this, but you just need to communicate better.
So
as a result, as you said, it got voted down. Now, it'll go to the board of directors. The board can do whatever it wants to. It doesn't have to abide by the rule or the vote of the planning commission. So, and that's coming up June 6th, I believe.
Yeah, I was going to ask, how dramatic a development is this? I mean, it's not going to put the kibosh on this pilot training center.
No, I don't think it will. No, I can't imagine it would. I think this is more Fort Smith just kind of needs to get its act together, communicate better, let folks know where the rules came from, where the requirements came from. You know, they've already pivoted. The city's already pivoted or moderated a lot of them, which raises the question, if you can moderate one, why can't you moderate some of these others that are controversial? So I suspect the members of the board of directors are getting an earful about this, or will get an earful before the June 6th meeting.
Well, let's stay with flying. The enplanement numbers for Fort Smith Airport up more than 7% year to year.
Yes, I was kind of surprised when I checked my math a couple times. You know, I did go to a small rural school in Arkansas, so I checked my math a few times. But, yeah, 7.6%. Usually when the enplanements at the Fort Smith Airport are up, it's, you know, as you know, you've been helping me cover it, too. It's 2%, 3%. It's rarely this much. So, yeah, 7.6% through April. And that kind of – that it's not the same period, but the U.S. Bureau of Transportation Statistics looks at a 12-month period up to February 2024, which is their latest data available. And their enplanements for that period across the U.S. Are up 8.1%. So it's pretty similar. But it's not just a positive trend, but it's a needed trend because the airport, as we talked before, is trying to convince other air carriers or American Airlines, which is the only carrier at the airport, to open open a route to the east, you know, St. Louis, Chicago. Right now, when you leave Fort Smith, you go through DFW, you go through Dallas-Fort Worth, everything.
Right.
You know, there used to be a Delta connection to Atlanta that could get you to the east, but that's stopped back in June 2021. So hopefully this trend will continue and it'll be enough to convince American or some other carrier to open that route to the east.
There's kind of a wish list for parks in Fort Smith, right?
Right. And we've learned more about this. Some of the project wish list, and this was a presentation to the Future Fort Smith Committee recently, you know, includes shade structures and electric for the Fort Smith Farmers Market. I've seen drawings of that. That would be very impressive. And it would be impressive right at the beginning of when you come into Fort Smith from Oklahoma in downtown Fort Smith. More planning needed for this Acme Brickyard, which we've talked about, which has a possibility to be a large, very unique and cool area in terms of outdoor activities. More shading and structures at the Riverfront Bike and Skate Park. And, of course, pickleball courts. Everybody loves their pickleball, so they want to put pickleball courts in most of the parks. So I sometimes wonder maybe Fort Smith will get all the pickleball courts built by the time that fad fades. I don't know, but maybe it's not a fad. But anyway, Sarah Duster, who's director of Parks and Recreation, this kind of this wish list, she valued that it would – she estimated that it would cost about $46 million to build. And LaVon Morton, City Director LaVon Morton, you know, piped in and said, well, you know, we've got money coming in, but we don't have that much, and it'll be grants. We're going to need some federal grants to do these projects. There seems to be more momentum, more groups involved. There's more money to support these projects through a sales tax that the voters approved. And I kind of think maybe if you had a time machine, it could travel maybe 10 years ahead. If you were able to move ahead, you might be impressed with what's been accomplished. I hope my optimism is rewarded on that front.
Well, how does this proposed Bass Reeves Legacy Loop Trail figure into this?
Yeah, well, it's somewhat separate, although it's still, the city hired a year or two ago, a gentleman named Michael Meigs. He's the chief of mobility or the mobility guy. I'm sorry, I forget his exact title, but he's pulled together this mobility master plan, and it includes they are seeking a $25 million grant from the feds for this Bass Reeves Legacy Loop Trail. It's a 14-mile kind of a greenway loop. Obviously, your listeners in Northwest Arkansas are familiar. It's very similar to the Razorback Greenway.
Mm-hmm.
But it would include 9 miles of new trails. He says that the loop would be accessible to 20% of Fort Smith residents. I think that's pretty interesting. The loop would connect 8 schools.
Wow.
Allow kids to ride, to walk, or ride bikes to schools. Ming said that the city should know in June if it receives the grant. If it does, I guess the only kind of downside, sometimes, you know, we all want it right now, right?
Right.
But building this loop could take 5 to 6 years if they get the grant. Yeah. If they don't get the grant, he didn't discuss a plan B, but I've just, in my limited discussions I've had with folks, this has really kind of created some excitement. Some, you know, I've even heard some folks say, well, if we don't get the grant, we need to find a way to make that happen. So
exciting.
We'll see. Yeah, it is. It could be very cool. So
you know,
we'll
what
see.
I would love to see a trail that goes from Fort Chaffee to downtown Joplin.
Downtown Joplin?
Yeah, I mean, it would stretch all the way, right? Because you'd connect Fort Smith to Northwest Arkansas and then get into to Southwest Missouri. Wouldn't that be cool?
Look, Kyle, I know that your dog takes you on some long, long walks, but I don't think you or your dog has that kind of energy. But good luck with it, brother.
All right. Well, maybe if we have the ability to look 50 years in the future, we'll find that trail.
Yeah, and you can find maybe my market where they spread my ashes along that trail somewhere 50 years in the future.
Michael Tilley is with Talk Business. You can read about all of this, not my proposed trail, but everything else we've talked about at talkbusiness.net. Michael, let's talk again next week, all right?
Okay, well, if you're not too exhausted.
Okay, thank you.
I'm walking, here's the knee, and I'm talking.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Bentonville Public Library is open, as usual, today and tomorrow. The Bentonville Library will be closed, as is normal, Sunday. But for 2 weeks beginning Monday, the library will remain closed so some renovations and installations of new equipment can take place. This morning, I talked with Hattie Dudley, Library Director, about those next 2 weeks for the library.
It's kind of a difficult decision to close down temporarily for 2 weeks while we make some springtime renovations to our front area of the library. With our expansion and renovation project, we really have just had to kind of schedule and phase the work so that it gets done in an efficient manner and also in a safe manner for our staff, the construction team, and of course our patrons.
Safe, right, because there's a wall or two that is going to come down?
There's a giant brick wall that's going to come down. And I think that I kind of dread hearing that work happening. While the library is closed to the public for the 2 weeks, May 20th through June 2nd, my team will be here working. We have a lot of work to do. We're helping install the 9-bin book sorting system that will be operational on June 3rd for the patrons to use. We're relocating the Friends of the Library's bookstore, which will be open June 3rd for patrons to browse and purchase books. We're relocating service desks and staff work areas. And then we're also getting ready for summer reading club. So we've got a lot of books to prep. We want to get them on the shelves and also prepping for an opening day collection this fall. So we'll be here working hard, getting new heat and air units installed on the roof, just a lot of really good work's happening that's significant improvements that's going to set us up for success for summer, being open for the patrons, and then moving to the addition and future renovations this fall.
The 9-bin sorting system. I'm not well enough versed in library mechanics or jargon to understand exactly what a 9-bin sorting system means. It sounds big. It sounds efficient. It sounds new. What is it?
Yes. So I often call it an automated materials handling system, which sounds really major, right? It's right. Really techy and fancy. And it is. It's very techy. It's very fancy. It is basically a fancy book drop. So patrons will put their books or audiobooks or videos in the slot. It accepts them on a conveyor belt and then transfers them to a place where it checks it in for us using radio frequency technology, and then it sorts it to a bin. So right now we have three bins, and our circulation has grown so much over the years, we really needed to expand our capacity to be able to handle more materials. So we're going from three bins to nine bins, and where it's being installed is really cool. You'll have to come see it. It's right inside the front door. We've got glass walls. And patrons can literally see where their book goes. It's like travels of a library book. Put it in, see it checked in. Oh, it's going to that bin. So it's kind of a cool, newfangled thing that we've been using the system for a while, but the patrons actually get to see it in action. The magic behind the curtain, if you will.
You mentioned growth. We just got this week, the U.S. Census Bureau released a, you know, estimated population. Centerton is growing. Bentonville is growing. All of Benton County is growing. So that means the library has to grow with the county.
Yes, exactly. And that's the catalyst for our whole project that we're doing for the community. We're playing a little catch up here at the library to catch up with the growth. Bentonville Public Library does serve all of Benton County residents at no cost. So Centerton, Bella Vista, they're in our Bentonville school district. So we do serve those residents free. So that growth is impacting, of course, our services here, as well as Bentonville's growth, which is huge. By the way, we also have a reciprocal agreement with Fayetteville Library. So we like to partner with Fayetteville quite a bit.
All right. What if I have a book that's due on May 26th? Am I going to get charged a fine because you're closed?
You will not have a book due on May 26th. Guess what? Everybody who came in got extra time on their checkouts leading up to our closure. So we extended due dates. We are not charging fines or fees during the closure. Beginning June 3rd, though, if something's late, people better get it back to us. But definitely tried to make it as user-friendly as possible because we know it's a bit of an inconvenience to not be able to come in the building. We're beefing up some of our online resources, our ebooks. We're going to add some ebooks to the collection so patrons can access those through Libby, and encourage people to use Freegle or Libby magazines, or even our streaming video service, Canopy. We want people to use that as well, and hopefully that will help them out.
This will
our book drop here that people drive through can be used. People can still drop off books here, and our community center little library will be operational as well.
Normally closed on Sunday, so May 19th, but May 20th is the first day that you'll be closed that you normally wouldn't be.
Correct. And that is when our new book sorter arrives. It's being transported right now from Minneapolis. Once we get it operational, if we can manage to pull it together, we're going to try to do a little time-lapse video to share with the public. We're going to try and communicate some of this with our patrons so they can see the improvements that are happening. And we eventually, I think, want to give this new sorting system a fancy name or a publicly decided name. So look for that kind of naming opportunity to come. We're going to have a little fun with it.
And then June 3rd, you'll be back open, the summer reading program, and all of that begins.
Yeah, and the summer feeding program will begin the same day, and we'll just be here. And we will still be under construction, Kyle. There will be still quite a bit going on. So, but people will get to see some improvements right away, June 3rd.
Well, best of luck during the 2 weeks that the construction and demolition and installations are happening. And I want to come look at the nine-bin sorter up close.
Yes, definitely. We'll let you empty the book bins and help us shelf them. Shelf books. We'll put you to work, Kyle.
I'll have to brush up on the Dewey Decimal System.
Yes,
I'll have to do that.
But, that's good. We'll give you the grace.
I'd be happy to help. Hattie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
Hattie Dudley is the library director of the Bentonville Public Library and spoke with me this morning via Zoom. The library will be open tomorrow, then closed until June 3rd. You can learn more about the ongoing expansion project at bentonvillelibrary.org.
How did our response to the COVID pandemic reflect our culture? This week, I chat with a bioethicist to understand how our attitudes towards public health have changed.
now the conversations are, how do we balance what people want and what vulnerable people need? Even individual behaviors, no matter how good they are, they're not going to save us.
Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
It's Been a Minute, tomorrow beginning at 10 on 91.3 KUAF. Fayetteville's population is over the 100,000 person threshold. The United States Census Bureau released new population numbers yesterday, and that report places the city's population at 101,680 people, an increase of more than 7,000 people in 3 years. Springdale, now with nearly 89,000 people, is closing in on the distinction of being the state's third largest city. There are now about 1,500 fewer residents in Springdale than Fort Smith. Little Rock remains easily the largest city in Arkansas with more than 203,000 people. Since spring 2020, Centerton in Benton County has grown dramatically from 17,800 residents in April 2020 to nearly 24,000 people today. There will be two special nominating conventions next month in Benton County to fill vacancies in a race for the county's quorum court. Both the Democratic and Republican parties had candidates run unopposed for nominations for the District 4 Justice of the Peace position in the March primary. But both of those candidates have now withdrawn from the race. Both parties had asked Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders for new candidates to be able to be selected by convention. She issued those orders yesterday. Baptist Health in Fort Smith is opening a milk depot at its medical center in Fort Smith in support of the University of Arkansas for Medical Sciences Milk Bank. The Fort Smith Baptist Health Milk Depot is a designated space for women to donate milk, which will be sent to the UAMS Milk Bank for screening, pasteurization, and nutritional analysis. After processing, milk will be sent, according to need, to hospitals throughout Arkansas. The Fort Smith Baptist Health Milk Depot is located at 1500 Dodson Avenue, Suite 140 in Fort Smith, and is open Monday through Friday from 1 until 4 p.m. And Hagan Smith is now the all-time strikeout king in Arkansas Razorback baseball history. He fanned 14 Texas A&M batters in 6 innings last night, but the Razorbacks were equally stymied by Aggie pitching and lost 1-0 in 11 innings. The teams are playing again tonight in College Station. If Arkansas wins either tonight or Saturday in Texas, they'll clinch the SEC West Championship. This is Ozarks at Large. It's a Friday, so that means it's time to bring in Becca Martin Brown, arts and entertainment editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat-Gazette.
Live and in person.
That's right. Welcome back to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio.
Thank you. It's so much fun when I can see Kyle's face when I say outrageous things. It just makes it so much more entertaining.
I'm sure it does for you, yes.
So, way back in the day, shortly after the dinosaurs roamed the earth, there was a thing in my hometown called Farm City Days.
Farm City Days.
You know, county seat, agricultural hub of the county.
Sure.
And it wasn't a big deal, but everybody came to it because it was the thing that said it was fall.
It was a harbinger. It was, yeah, of course.
It happened before school started, but after summer vacations.
Right.
And you knew when it was time for Farm City Days, it was fall. So our concept this week is things that are sure signs
that it's
of the season.
Okay.
And my favorite is the White Street Walk.
In Eureka Springs.
It is this Friday, starting at 4 o'clock. It doesn't matter if you have a lot of money. It doesn't matter if you don't buy art. If you like art, you go to Eureka Springs. Zeke Taylor will feed you.
Yeah, there's usually cookies and brownies and lemonade and tea.
Oh, yeah. Zeke bakes cookies for weeks and freezes them so that he can share them with people who come to his house. You get to see cool Victorian houses. You get to meet new artists.
Right, because it's not just the artists who live on White Street. Don't some artists, some homeowners there invite people to come in? Yes.
It started being a thing for artists who live on White Street. But now they invite artists in to fill up all the little cubby holes.
Right.
And you'll see all your friends. And you can go eat in Eureka Springs. But I swear to you, I cannot take 5 steps.
And not know someone?
And not know someone.
Yeah. It's a good time.
So it's a good time. It's from 4 to 10 o'clock on Friday. You want to get there early if you want to park. Particularly if you want to park at Ermelio's, which I do. So somebody save me a parking space. Among the other artists showing at White Street Walk this year are Mark Hughes, Gina Galena, Rosie Rose, Sandra Spots, Chad Wilson, Barbara Kennedy, Maureen Daly, and of course, one of the other founders, Mary Springer.
And that the artists you just mentioned cover a wide range of types of art.
Oh, yeah.
Fashion to crochet to two-dimensional.
I have a new piece of Mary Springer art that we bought at the ESSA sale.
Mm-hmm.
And it's steampunk.
Eureka Springs School of the Arts.
Yes.
That's what you meant by ESSA. Yes.
They knew that.
No, not everyone does. Not everyone does.
Maybe I'm so used to acronyms. I apologize. The Eureka Springs School of the Arts.
Yes.
So there's one sure sign of Springs. If you miss the fall arts festivals being the big deal they used to be, I don't know if that's ever coming back. But the Village Art Club in Bella Vista that used to do the big show up there in the fall is doing a little spring show.
Okay.
And this is like their third one. And it's happening just outside the Wishing Spring Gallery, which is, to me, that's the south end of Bella Vista. Down at the end of Bella Vista where they keep Lowe's and Walgreens.
Right.
McNally Road.
Right.
And they're going to have like 40 artists. They're juried. And some of the pictures are fabulous. There's a good sterling silver artist.
Okay.
So you could make that a sure sign of spring.
Sure.
Like you go, you support it, it becomes a thing.
Exactly.
And that happens from 9 to 5 today and 9 to 5 tomorrow. Admission is free. I bet they have a food truck. If they don't, McDonald's is across the street.
Right. You know. Yes.
So you can make that a thing. Then you can also make a thing out of the fact that tomorrow is the season opening of the Chaffee Crossing Food and Arts Market.
This isn't the first one of these.
No. This is the first one for the year, though.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
And they, you know, they came along with all the development at Chaffee Crossing and grew up to be huge. And they're really like a big deal in Fort Smith. So you could do that on Saturday and make it your thing.
Sure.
That starts at, let's see, 8 o'clock on Saturday, 8 to 1. Or there's a brand new opportunity to create a thing.
And that is?
The Strawberry Festival Sunday.
The inaugural one in Fayetteville.
I'm not sure why strawberries.
You know, I know that, isn't it Stillwell, Oklahoma? In the summer or fall, don't they have a strawberry festival?
I don't know.
I think they do. They have. But anyway, this one's in
Fayetteville. Northwest Arkansas has been apples. It's been grapes. You know, why not strawberries?
Because they're great. Strawberries are great.
Yeah. And they're going to have music like, oh, the best band in the world, Trout Fishing in America, and Dandelion Heart, Noah Richmond's Little Monster, and a pie competition, and a honky-tonk street dance, and beer and strawberries.
There you go. Well.
Probably not together.
Maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's from noon to 6 on Sunday on the Fayetteville Square. It's the very first one. Admission's free. And you can make it a thing. This can be your thing.
So next year you would say, hey, it's the Strawberry Festival in the Fayetteville Square. It's now spring. The ability to make a left turn this week, easier because it's kind of quiet. I mean, we'll have summer school and everything, but I love this week because it is a little quieter for just a little bit in Fayetteville.
We lived right off campus for all the years I was married to my daughter's dad. And everything ticks along based on where the kids are.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of nice to be in town. Bella Vista doesn't care. It doesn't care what the kids are doing down here. But it's nice to come to Fayetteville and feel that zen.
And you know, I'm not saying that
I love the kids. I love the energy.
But for 1 week, it's nice to just be a little bit calm.
Well, it's kind of the opposite of Eureka Springs, because if you go up to the White Street Walk, it will be busier than what you're used to. It won't have that zen.
Right.
But it's cool and worth it. It's also when my boyfriend and I celebrate our anniversary, because we can't remember when we met. So we just, it's a floating anniversary on the day of the White Street Walk.
I think that's pretty healthy. All right. Becca Martin Brown is the arts and entertainment editor at the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette.
There's a dragon exterminator who loves dragons and hates his job, a take charge princess, and a wizard who just keeps talking, all in Peter S. Beagle's latest novel.
What worries me about this book is that I like it. I never like books when I'm through with them. I always know what I've screwed up.
I'm afraid you've got dragons and the latest news, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Weekend Edition with Scott Simon tomorrow morning beginning at 7. Time to wrap up our series of conversations with the three finalists in the contest to select a new theme for KUAF's Community Spotlight. Yesterday, Drew Hudson Rogers visited with me in the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio. This is his submission for the new theme. It's titled In Between Radio. Drew says the inspiration for his song and the inspiration for entering the contest rooted in Northwest Arkansas.
So I was talking to a good friend of mine the other day, and we were talking about being torchbearers for this genre that we call Heartland Rock. And I want to be clear, I didn't invent that term, but I use it pretty regularly. So this is rock and roll that has a storyteller element to it. It has sort of a folk influence, a little bit of a country influence. If we want to put names with it, think of guys like Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers, or a modern example would be like Jason Isbell. So it's Midwest rock. It's mid-Southern rock. It's blue-collar rock, however you want to put it. It's that. It's
hard
that,
on your sleeve.
Yeah, hard on your sleeve, kind of that timeless American tradition of songwriting and guitar and rock and roll and that whole thing. So
what about the title?
So the title of the song is In Between Radio, and that's kind of alluding to my growing up in Arkansas and kind of being an Ozarks kid and not knowing where I fit in or how I fit in from a social standpoint. My mom and my dad got divorced when I was like 4, and my mom lived in town, and my dad lived in southern Missouri in a real small town. And his side of the family was from Kansas, like grew up working on the farm, like that's that side of the family. And then my mom's side, basically teachers, you know, like my mom's an art teacher. So it was always this thing of like, I didn't know if I fit in the city or if I fit in the country. And I felt like too much of a country kid for the city kids and too much of a city kid for the country kids. So there was that element. There was also, you know, like in high school, I was kind of a jock, honestly. Like I played sports. I was good at sports. I was a good runner. That was more of the crowd that I hung out mm-hmm. with in high school. But I knew I wasn't one of the popular kids because I had this secret, which was that I would go home and write songs and play guitar. And I was a creative at heart, you know, and that always felt like a sort of like a boundary that I wasn't allowed to cross. And I don't know if it's still that way for kids, but 12 years ago, it sure felt like that, you know. So, yeah, just feeling like a social in-betweener and like an in-betweener in a lot of ways. And then kind of combining that with the musical influences I have, which are all over the map, you know. We touched on it, but, you know, a lot of country was on the radio as a kid growing up in Arkansas and more like rural environments. A lot of rock and roll, like, you know, that's the big thing. That like 70s and 80s rock and roll was kind of the big thing for me. But, you know, I have a master's degree in jazz guitar. Like I've become a little bit well-versed in terms of my musical background. So I feel like I have a strong appreciation for everything, and I want to try to create that cross section, you know.
What would it mean if, like, you end up having the submitted composition that wins? It's the new theme for Community Spotlight, and it's on for thousands of listeners every morning.
That would honestly mean a ton. It would be a fabulous full circle moment for me, just in terms of what the music means, what it stands for, who I'm trying to reach, in terms of, you know, broadcasting this narrative, like, it's okay to be an in-betweener. You know, as Arkansans, I feel like a lot of us are this way, you know, and So just to have the chance to represent the community in a small way, especially the community that I'm proud to be from, and I feel like my music is a product of, that would be huge for me.
This past weekend, I was on Mount Sequoia on Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And talked to someone who had seen you play on Mount Sequoia Friday
night. Barely missed me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I know. I had something else going on that on the Friday night. And they mentioned how much they enjoyed your show. Mm-hmm. And so it was out there in the little, it's not even an amphitheater. It's
like, yeah, what is it?
It's where they would have Easter morning service. Yeah, there's a little altar
it's
there.
It's almost an amphitheater.
Yeah, almost an amphitheater. Yeah. But I'm wondering, so the night you were playing was the night the Northern Lights.
Yes.
By any chance, did you get to see them while you were playing? Or?
No, because I was the opener. Uh-huh. And so by the time we packed up, and by the way, we opened for Dylan Earle, who played a great set. What a great voice he's got, by the way. So we were packed up, and I actually had to go to a friend's house because we were making some merch. We were screen printing some T-shirts, and I was told, like, oh, my God, look outside, the Northern Lights. And apparently we missed it because I didn't see them. But, I had friends from out of state texting me, like, Did you see him? Nope. Sorry.
So the interesting thing is, I haven't talked personally to anyone who did see them.
Interesting.
All these people
online. If you scroll Facebook, you'll think that the whole dang town.
I think you had to be at the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
Okay. One last question. If you win and you get that East Hall recording, do you know what you're going to record?
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. I've got a handful of songs that would be good contenders, but I've got one specifically in mind that's it's a new song called Ghost Runner that I'm really excited about, and I think it also does a good job of kind of encapsulating that Heartland Rock vibe, so I think that would be the one we take to him.
Congratulations for making the final three.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for coming in.
Absolutely. Thanks for
having
me. Where
can people find out more about you?
DrewHudsonRogers.com is my website. Also on Instagram, I am just Drew Hudson Rogers. That's Hudson with a T, by the way. So, yep.
Thank you, Drew.
Thank you.
Drew Hudson Rogers is a finalist in the contest to select a new theme for KUAF's Community Spotlight. You can learn more about the contest and the other two finalists by going to the KUAF Instagram page. A new theme will be announced early next month.
For the Central Arkansas Library System, I'm Mark Chris with an Encyclopedia of Arkansas Minute. A Depression-era minor league baseball team had a brief but storied career in Northwest Arkansas. The Arkansas State League began on May 8, 1934 as part of the St. Louis Cardinals farm system. Fayetteville, Salem Springs, Rogers, and Bentonville established teams based on their size, financial stability, and local competitiveness. Huntsville joined a year later, but dropped out in 1936, replaced by teams from Cassville and Monett, Missouri. The league was renamed the Arkansas-Missouri League that year. Frances Sunny Dunlop, a local female athlete, played a full game in right field for Fayetteville on September 6, 1936, the first time a woman played on a men's professional team. Cassville and Bentonville left the league that year, replaced by Neosha, Missouri, and Vanita, Oklahoma. Carthage, Missouri joined the league in 1938 as Fayetteville and Salem Springs dropped out. But financial problems, dwindling local support, and a looming world war forced the league to fold in 1940. To learn more, visit encyclopediaofarkansas.net.
I have good news and I have better news. The good news, it is spring. We always love spring. The better news, it's time for a new batch of conversations about books with Pastor Clint Schneckloth, who is the pastor at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville. Happy spring.
Happy spring, and yes, we have a big stack of books here.
We really do. And we're going to start. Our first conversation is about this year's Hugo nominees, and Hugo is the award for
Best Fantasy Science Fiction.
Right.
In a bunch of categories, actually.
Right.
Yeah. So the story of the Hugos this year inevitably has to include the story of last year's Hugos. Last year, the Hugos were in China, and this was a big deal. The Chinese won the bid to host the Hugos because they travel.
Right.
You can make a bid to host it when you have what's called Worldcon. It's the World Science Fiction Convention. Mm-hmm. And then that's where the Hugos take place. And of course, there was a certain level of nervousness around that, and also interest. You know, like the Chinese it's a big place, and there's a lot of science fiction.
There's a lot of
done
science fiction that is emerging to a Western audience, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So there's a lot of interest, but then there was also a lot of concern. You know, people who felt they couldn't travel there if they were, out and queer and
right.
other things like that. And so there was a lot of mixed reaction. So we got to the Hugos in China, and it turned out that the Hugo Awards team secretly and without letting anybody know, excluded some nominees that had won enough votes.
But the Chinese government wouldn't be okay with their...
Well, that's what you would think.
Uh-huh.
And you'd be wrong.
Oh.
The Chinese government, now it turns out, had nothing to do with this.
It was internal?
It was internal.
Oh, that's not a good look.
It's a horrible look. It boils down to, I learned this term because as I was reading, there's a bunch of really long blog analyses of what happened. A couple of the people eventually released a bunch of internal like memos and emails that showed what all had happened. Mm-hmm. So we have a somewhat good picture of what went down. The why is less known. The term I learned was that basically this team had a missing stare. There's one guy that was on the team who kind of was the most involved in having made this happen. And they pre-vetted and decided certain books wouldn't get onto the final
No matter how list. Much support they had or how many votes.
And in fact, they had enough votes. There was one in particular that's kind of everybody's just really alarmed that it didn't make it onto there. They gave reasons in those emails, and they were things like, this person visited Tibet.
So there was some concern.
It was framed as right. if it were trying to match the political concerns of the Chinese.
Of the host country.
Of the host country. But first, they had that wrong. That person had visited Nepal, not Tibet. Another book that actually made it onto the list, that author had visited Tibet. So it was ill-informed in that case. And then there's no indication that the leadership from China of this put any pressure at all. It was all internal from this international group to make these kinds of decisions. Bottom line, it caused a huge level of doubt to emerge about the validity of the Hugos. And
which have been around for decades.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so now all the authors who might be nominated this year have had to give some thought to, should I allow my nomination to go forward? Because if it, like some of the authors that got nominated last year for China, like an example of somebody who's nominated this year, John Scalzi, one of his previous books was nominated for the Chinese slate. And now knowing what they know, he knows his book shouldn't have been. So what should he do this year? And they've had to go public on why or why not they're allowing their books to go forward.
Well, and I imagine what's more interesting or makes this more interesting is that publishing houses love to put on books Hugo nominated or Hugo award
right.
winner. I mean, it's not the same to scale as getting an Oprah endorsement.
In the science fiction fantasy world, it's huge.
Well, and it also gets you out that I have read that on a book gets you also outside of the people who might be looking primarily for science fiction books.
Right.
More, quote, general readers will see that and go, oh, it won the Hugo.
Correct.
Right. So it's we're talking some money here.
Yes, it's big. And a couple of the people quit. None of the team that was on that team is on the team that's now this year. It's going to be in Scotland.
Okay.
And this slate is selected by a different group. But what this means for this year's Hugo is, in a way, you can trust it more than you can trust any.
Okay.
you know, think about the immense scrutiny that's on this group to get it right, to be transparent about the voting process, all this kind of thing. So when they published the Hugo nominations this year, they published even far more information than sometimes has been published in the past. So I'm only going to give you the example. You know, the Hugos, they nominate novellas and novelettes and fanzines and editors and all kinds of stuff. But I'm just going to focus on the best novel part. So they published the 6 books that are nominated. And then they told you how many ballots were cast and for how many nominees. So like how many different books were nominated and how many voters there were. And then it gives you the finalist range, which means that the finalists got between blank and blank number of votes. So there were 1,420 ballots cast for 576 nominees, and the finalist range is 91 to 172. this also illustrates something fascinating about the Hugos, which is it's not a big group. Anybody,
right.
So like I went to the Hugo Awards and WorldCon a couple years ago in Seattle, and so then I was a voting delegate that year, and anybody can be one of these voters.
Oh, okay.
You just pay your membership. It's like $50 or whatever, and then you can also cast your ballots. You have to know enough about the literature to actually jump in there and say, like, I'm nominating this book or whatever, but it means that whoever ends up becoming the Hugo winner was elected from just a slate of 1,400 ballots.
Sure.
You know, that's not very big. So the other historical scandal that happened was about 9 years ago in the Hugos, and there was this whole sad puppy movement. Do you remember seeing this?
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah. So there was one other time where they tried to kind of like game the Hugos, and it was a sad puppies
right.
group that thought that the Hugos were becoming too politically correct,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted more just popular novels by white men.
Mm.
And so they put together a slate, and then they recruited all these voters.
Of course. Why? I mean, when you were explaining how this happens, of course, why would – you're naive to think that this couldn't happen.
Right. And so then there was a big fiasco there for a couple of years where – and this is really a fascinating kind of political dynamic. The whole science fiction fan world realized what was happening with the sad puppies thing. When you go to actually vote on the books that are nominated,
mm-hmm.
one of your options is to you can upvote a thing called like it's like no winner.
Like so, none of the above.
So you can choose none of the above as one of your votes. And so since they knew that the sad puppies had packed the slate
uh-huh.
with all the sad puppy nominees, the general group of WorldCon attendees voted no winner. So there was no Hugo Award that year.
You know, you look at the list and you see that one year, and I just
yeah.
– usually you see that and it's, well, there's a world war or a pandemic. No, this was infighting.
Yeah, and so then there's a process within the Hugos to change the rules for the Hugos, and it takes a couple of years because they have like business meetings where they do this, and they change the rules to modify how much impact a slate can have. So here are the novels that were nominated this year. It's kind of a fascinating list. Martha Wells' Witch King.
Mm-hmm.
Martha Wells is most famous for her Murderbot series.
Okay.
Very popular. But The Witch King is her going back to fantasy.
As opposed to sci-fi.
Gotcha. And the basic premise is this, the main character is this like very powerful being from the underworld who can't die and inhabits flesh and kind of, okay. So he's kind of like dark, but mm-hmm. he's the protagonist nevertheless.
Okay.
Translation State by Anne Leckie. Also very popular novelist, Ancillary Justice, and this trilogy that she's been working on has been on the bestseller list. This is the third volume in the trilogy. Truly weird stuff. It's like along the lines of Octavia Butler with different races of extraterrestrials blending and kind of coming together and not being able to tell the difference between AI and human and alien. Starter Villain by John Scalzi. John Scalzi is probably the most popular science fiction novelist in the country right now.
Right.
Starter Villain, he's been doing this series lately where he doesn't do the big space opera stuff. He does these really funny, kind of lighthearted novels. And the basic premise is just this guy who wants to own a bar. His uncle turns out to be a supervillain. And he becomes his, like, heir for a time and has to live in that world. So you, like, get exposed to this world of supervillains. And the supervillains created cats that are intelligent.
Yeah.
So it turns out that tracks. Yes. So it turns out his cats can, like, talk.
Okay.
Have been protecting him and whatever. And then you go from there. Some Desperate Glory is a space opera by Emily Tesh. It's her first novel. And it's kind of like, this is the stuff the sad puppies wouldn't like. It's like queer space opera. The Saint of Bright Doors by Vajra Chandra Sekera. And this one is like really cool, I think, because this is, I think this is an emerging science fiction kind of genre that's really popular right now, and I love it. The most popular novelist that's like this is Sarah Maas. You've probably seen those big fat books that she's got everywhere. And The Saint of Bright Doors is like this. So it's like high fantasy, but in a modern world. So, you know, while they're using magic, they're also sending each other's texts and emails and, you know, that kind of like melding of the two.
Right.
In a kind of Asian context. And then the last one, The Adventures of Amina al-Sirafi by Shannon Chakraborty. This is the one that I'm probably the most excited to read. I've was happy that I'd already read four before I saw the slate. I've got two I need to read. And this one is basically like a pirate adventure, but on the Indian Ocean.
Okay.
And so in that kind of medieval culture
right.
of that place and space. And so all of the fantasy is more in the kind of the context of like jinn and magic in the Islamic Sufi world. And it's going to be really interesting to see how this moves forward, because there's going to be a lot of chatter the whole way, you know, about what happened last year in China and how they're going to make it right in Scotland.
I also want to point out that the people who win the Hugos, the contemporary awards this year, the last few years, pay attention to those names, because many of the winners in their contemporary times become sort of these tentpole names in science fiction. Isaac Asimov, Ray Bradbury.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, these very influential.
Yeah, and I want to mention this at the end because it's so huge. But that year that the Sad Puppies came in, then the year that they actually got back to having a novel that actually wins, mm-hmm. it was Qizhen Liu's The Three-Body Problem.
Which is now this huge show.
Netflix show.
Right.
Chinese.
That's right.
Right? And so they were trying to fight off, you know, international. His was also the first Hugo ever to be a translated novel.
Mm.
Always before that, they had been naturally written in English. And so Three-Body Problem was the first time a translated novel was the Hugo
Interesting.
Winner. Yeah, so they become huge. And the other thing I want to mention, just because I think it's kind of a big deal for like thinking about China in relationship to this, one of the things that many of the bloggers have pointed out about this fiasco of the Hugos in China is that this was not what the science fiction fans in China wanted.
Right.
Like they want to be a part of the international community.
Of course.
And to be alienated in this way, and in this case, not even by their own doing, but because the international team was trying to think like
mm-hmm.
them somehow in a weird way, is really problematic.
And after you've read all six, when you come back for summer or something, I want to hear who you would have voted for.
Okay.
All right.
I will do that.
Pastor Clint Schneckloth gives us book recommendations and book information, often on Ozarks at Large. Thank you, Pastor Clint.
Welcome.
Monday on Ozarks, we conclude our survey of a conversation Hillary Rodham Clinton had with the Pryor Center for Arkansas Oral and Visual History about her time living in Arkansas.
Well, I had so many formative years here. And, you know, I was privileged to see just about every aspect of Arkansas life across the state and to work with some of the successful companies that were born right here in Arkansas.
That's on Mondays. Ozarks at Large. Ozarks at Large, a production of 91.3 KUAF Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Michael Tilley, Becca Martin Brown, and Mark Christ. Thanks to Pastor Clint Schneckloth for his time discussing Hugo-nominated books. Our theme, written and performed by Daryl Sean. Our membership director at KUAF is Lisa Ault. From the Carver Center for Public Radio, I'm Kyle Kellums.
KUAF is partnering with Old Friend Farms to give away tickets to the Old Friends Music Festival May 24th through the 26th. It includes live music and camping in the Boston Mountains. Full lineup available at oldfriendfarms.com. Giveaway entry at KUAF.com. Support for KUAF comes from East Hall Recording Studio, located at 4210 North Salem Road in Fayetteville. East Hall offers fully equipped recording sessions with an engineer for full groups or individuals. Full list of services, equipment, and booking information at easthall.com.